Professor Alfred McCoy is a Harrington Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author most recently of Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation, and co-editor of Endless Empire, Europe's Eclipse, Spain's Retreat, America's Decline. He also writes for Times Dispatch, where his latest article, Grand Master of the Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China, cast a whole new light on the president's foreign policy capabilities, presenting a very different picture than what one reads in the mainstream press or hears and sees on the popular Sunday news shows. We previously spoke in 2013 concerning Professor McCoy's essay on the making of the surveillance state. It turned out to be one of my most listened to programs on the Internet. I think this one might be as well. Welcome once again, Professor Alfred McCoy, to Takes on the World.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Though virtually all of President Obama's term in office, he has been accused by Republicans and some Democrats of being clueless when it comes to foreign policy and dealing with America's adversaries and rivals, not least of which is China. But almost in sync with the arrival of Chinese President Xi Jinping to meet with Obama, your article completely overturns what has become the conventional picture of the president as presented in the mainstream media. You make a convincing argument. Perhaps you could start with the basic framework.
Sure. Look, most media commentators and even most historians look at foreign policy. They judge what you call, might call sort of medium weight or mid-band issues of the way that a U.S. president negotiates treaties, interacts with leaders, and manages the crisis du jour, whether it's the Middle East or Asia or wherever it might be. And what I'm talking about is something deeper and longer and ultimately, I think, more significant and more substantial, geopolitics. Now, there's a relationship between foreign policy and geopolitics, but they're not the same. We've had a string of presidents throughout the 20th century and into the 21st who have been reasonably competent in the realm of foreign policy. Almost any American leader, given the enormous strength economically and militarily of this country, who is generally competent, can manage U.S. foreign policy pretty well. And that's all the way from Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, they're all pretty good at it, okay? And that's Republicans and Democrats alike. Foreign policy has traditionally been nonpartisan. But geopolitics requires something different, an uncommon ability to look beneath the chaos of the present and to bring two subtle issues into conjuncture, time and space. In other words, to make sure that your immediate foreign policy decisions are somehow impacting upon the complex undercurrents of changing global geopolitics in order to position the United States and to even change the world order in a fundamental and lasting kind of way. And the second ability you have to have, and this is very uncommon, is to have a kind of deep understanding, almost to the level of being an intuitive understanding of the culture, the people, and the places on the planet who some are the nations, if you will, the counters, the pieces on the global chessboard, so that when you make your move in the present to shape the future, you know pretty much what you're doing. And applying this standard means that when you look back, in my view, and others might disagree, over the century plus since the United States emerged on the world stage during the Spanish-American War of 1898, there have only been three American leaders who have been adept at this more subtle long-term art of geopolitics. The first was Elihu Root, who was a Secretary of War, which is like Secretary of Defense today. He was Secretary of State. He was a U.S. Senator from the state of New York. He was a plenipotentiary. He's a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, one of, I think, just American executive leaders to win it. He was the architect of U.S. global power. He transformed us from an insular nation into a major power. The second was Zbigniew Brzezinski. As a national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, he had an intuitive understanding of the master of geopolitics, the man who defined the field, a man named Sir Halford Mackinder. We can talk about him later. Brzezinski was a kind of intellectual acolyte of Mackinder, and he proved to be brilliant in manipulating the geopolitics that in a way that drew the Soviet Union and Afghanistan gave them what he called their Vietnam, and then half a world away broke up the Soviet Empire and freed Eastern Europe from the grip of Soviet dominion. And the most recent one, I would argue, is President Barack Obama, who is both is in a certain sense falling in the footsteps of both Elihu Root, protecting the U.S. position and the international community that Root helped to create, and retaining the United States status as a possibly retaining the United States status as the world's sole superpower, something that Zbigniew Brzezinski was largely responsible for by his deft defeat of the Soviet Union.
Well, you make an argument, and you bring up the two treaties, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the one with the European countries, European Union countries, that are designed to literally cut China, who is a major U.S. trading partner, to cut China not only from its Asian allies, but to cut us off, try and cut it off as much as it can from the rest of the world, including Africa, where as you show in your article, the Chinese have tremendous economic investments.
Yeah, Jeffy, do you mind if we just step back this and
sure.
talk about Halford Mackinder?
Sure.
Because what Obama's strategy is it's a counter to China's strategy, China's reach for geopolitical power. Now, everybody knows that China's emerging on the world stage in a kind of heavy-handed way. They're building those islands in the South China Sea. They sent icebreakers up into the Arctic when Obama was in Alaska. They're laying a claim for Antarctica. You know, they're moving and shaking on the global stage. This we know, okay? But to understand what China is really up to, we have to go back to a lecture on a dark London night in January 1904, when the director of the London School of Economics and a well-known British geographer gave a lecture called The Geographical Pivot of History. And this lecture is important in terms of what it said specifically about the Eurasian landmass, but it's more important because this lecture is the lecture that invented the study of geopolitics, okay? I mean, that, if you will, looked at the relationship between geography and political power and therefore global power. And what Sir Halford Mackinder said is he redrew the map. He took the globe and he twisted it so that he shifted it slightly north and he moved it so its center was right at the heart of the vast Eurasian landmass. And he said, when you look at the globe this way, what you see is that Europe, Africa, and Asia are not three continents. They're actually a single landmass that he called the World Island. And he said that the pivot, the geographical pivot of history, was in the heartland of the World Island, which is basically the vast steppes of the Soviet Union, 4,000 miles sort of stretching across the then Russia all the way up to the East Siberian Sea. And he said that he who controls the heartland controls the World Island, and he who controls the World Island controls the world. And Sir Halford Mackinder was writing, actually, at a moment when Tsarist Russia was just extending the Trans-Siberian Railway across the vast Eurasian landmass. So for the first time, the two continents were actually being joined by a logistical link, this great Trans-Siberian Railway. And what China began doing 10 years ago was realizing Sir Halford Mackinder's vision. They have spent and are spending the better part of $1 trillion to build an amazing array of gas pipelines, oil pipelines, high-speed rails across China, and rail links, potentially a high-speed rail link between Beijing and Moscow that's actually knitting together the world island right from the what Mackinder called the geographical pivot of history, the heartland of the world island, linking Central Asia to China. And then China's second part of its strategy, very closely linked to the first part, okay, was to defeat, to cut the encirclement of the world island. Now, at the end of World War II, and I'm drawing here upon the distinguished British imperial historian, a man named John Darwin. He He said the United States became the greatest empire in history because for the first time, the United States controlled both axial points of the Eurasian landmass, that through NATO and Western Europe and our relationship with Japan and East Asia, we had control over the axial points of the vast Eurasian landmass. And we, over the 50-plus years that followed World War II, we erected, if you will, a massive array of military power around the periphery of this giant world island. First of all, a string of treaties that stretch from NATO to CENTO to CETO, the Australia, New Zealand, U.S. Security Pact, the Japan, U.S. Security Treaty. And then we had our great fleets, the 6th Fleet, the 7th Fleet, and ultimately the 5th Fleet. And then most recently we built a string of something like 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily to Guam that allow our drones to strike all around this vast world island. And what China appears to be doing is strategically coming up with a way to cut through, to slice this massive U.S. armada that encircles the Eurasian landmass at two points. First, those islands in the South China Sea, and they are geopolitically very important. Also, the Chinese in their Hainan naval base are, in fact, homeporting nuclear submarines, which will be operating in the South China Sea. But of equal significance, the Chinese have built another point of attack. They have built, at the cost of something like $200 billion, a new port at Gwadar in Balochistan, Pakistan, just a day's sail from the Straits of Hormuz, the mouth of the strategically important Persian Gulf. And they are now, President Xi Jinping, in a recent state visit to Pakistan, announced the construction of a corridor of roads, rails, oil pipelines, gas pipelines that are going to run from Gwadar all the way to western China. And this gives China, if you will, a future home port right on the Arabian Sea, a day's steam, a day's sail from the Persian Gulf. And this way China can slice through the world island. Now, that's China's strategy, the world island strategy, if you will, a continental strategy. So what's Obama? About the time Obama took office, it was clear that China was making a bid, and nobody paid attention to it except the Obama administration. And secretly and subtly, they began preparing a counter strategy. And in the past few months, we've just begun to see it. And it's a two-part strategy. First of all, at the most visible level, the United States is negotiating two trade pacts, which are very controversial and have high costs. I'm not a keen fan of them myself, but nonetheless, geopolitically, they're very important. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a dozen nations, including the United States, in the most tight economic integration of any trade pact in history. And then the other one is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP. And these two treaties, if successful, will give the United States preferential access to about 60% of global domestic product, 60% of the world's economy. But what it'll do geopolitically is it's going to split the world island, this Eurasian landmass, okay, and pull the Asian half towards the United States across the Pacific, all right? And it's going to take the European Union, which has, by the way, the world's single largest economy, and split the western half of the Eurasian landmass, the European half, and pull that across the Atlantic, and thereby split apart China's bid to unify Africa, Asia, and Latin America economically and in terms of logistically into that unified world island. Geopolitically, it's a stunning move whose import, I think, you can only see when you realize that we're contesting China, we're containing China, and it's a bid that, more than any other single strategy, has a chance to extend U.S. global power, U.S. hegemony, U.S. dominion deeper into the 21st century. Sorry for talking so long.
No, I'm glad you interrupted me, because I actually was going to bring up Mackinder. I, I studied Mackinder when I was in the university many, many years ago. I remember the heartland theory, and that we don't hear and haven't heard about it for years, although it hasn't disappeared. It certainly hasn't been discussed. So I'm glad you brought that history also, Leo Root. Again, a figure that is not most Americans are not familiar with, and for probably very good reasons or very bad reasons. It's interesting when those two pacts came up, the insistence on secrecy, unprecedented, not letting even members of Congress go and bring in even a cell phone or take any notes about the pacts, and yet there was some resistance within the Democratic Party, but not significant in terms of what the pact implies. And you describe in your article, which I do recommend, it's available on Tom Dispatch, what the trade-off is in maintaining U.S. global power. The trade-off is in terms of what happens domestically and to workers' rights, both in foreign countries as well as the United States. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Sure. First of all, the secret negotiations, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and former Labor Secretary Robert Reich have both made the case very eloquently, very passionately, and I think very persuasively, that this really transgresses the authority of the Congress to review all foreign treaties and to ratify them. It really circumscribes Congress's authority. Furthermore, one of the most objectionable features of both treaties, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that it's going to create an arbitration tribunal. And my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, so this could be subject to correction, but basically, let's say a U.S. corporation or a foreign corporation hires arbitrators, all right, who will meet in the World Trade Organization headquarters in Europe, and they will rule on a complaint by a corporation that some aspect of U.S. labor law or environmental regulation infringes upon their right to do business, diminishes their profits. And a ruling by these appointed arbitrators who have no legal standing in the United States can, in theory, overrule the sovereign law and courts and the Constitution of the United States, and that by this treaty we're thereby bound to honor the ruling of this basically corporate-appointed arbitration panel. And the people are not standing judges. This is not the International Court of The Hague or something like that, where the judges have some kind of security of tenure and some kind of impartiality. These are arbitrators hired by the corporations and are sort of a revolving door. They come back for case after case. And potentially, this will give private interests a way of overruling laws that safety, environment that have been enacted by the Congress to protect the environment and protect American workers. And it's not only true for the United States, but it's also true for all the members of both PACs. If this is written into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so the dozen nations of that partnership are all going to be affected by that. And there's moves to bring in a similar clause into the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and so the EU will be similarly affected. Not only does this transgress the sovereignty, but it represents, I think, a fundamental shift in power away from the vote and democratic institutions and popular sovereignty to the limited interests of corporations, of specific corporations that have grievances, who feel that their profit-making opportunities have been transgressed. So there's the potential consequences of these treaties for the quality of American democracy and indeed democracy in all of the 40 nations that are affected by these two treaties are really quite significant. And when you add up the number of people and the countries involved, this could really be a diminution of democracy on a global scale. So once again, we're looking at something that recurs repeatedly in the history of modern empires. Okay, a kind of contradiction between, in the case of the United States, between global power or imperial power abroad and democracy at home, where that reach, that global, that international reach, damages democracy in the United States. And I think many critics have made that case, and I tend to agree with the critics. But nonetheless, when you're seated in the Oval Office in Washington, D.C., and it's your job to defend the power and authority and the hegemony of the United States on a global scale, which is what we seem to want our president to do, what Obama is doing is of lasting historical import. In terms of the geopolitics, these are subtle and significant moves.
My guest is Professor Albert McCoy. We're discussing his recent article, Grandmaster, The Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China. One thing that really was extraordinary was after there was mobilization to get Congress or the Senate to vote against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, suddenly we found out that the vote, they were going to vote until they got it right. And so they voted again, and now he has fast track on this.
Right, he has fast track, which circumscribes Congress's authority in the future, right? So it looks like the Trans-Pacific Partnership will likely go through. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, as it's called, is at an earlier stage of negotiations. First of all, there's substantial opposition in Europe. The European Union, of course, as we all know, it's a much weaker coalition. And so you're not just, I'm going to put it, that opponents have the capacity to influence the separate sovereign states of Europe and thereby influence the EU and to slow it down. So the opposition in Europe is a bit of a wild card. It's a very complex process. And it can turn in all kinds of surprising ways. So that's not as clear that that's going to happen. And the criticism in Europe of the circumscribing of democratic institutions in each of the European countries and in the European Union through this arbitration procedure, that's been very forcefully argued in Europe. So it's possible that treaty might not go through, but nonetheless, the United States and the Obama administration is pushing this treaty very, very hard, and it's possible that it'll go through. So, these are the two pieces of the puzzle. There's another dimension, by the way, of Obama's geopolitical strategy, I think, that also bears commenting on, is it's his determination, if you will, to repair the damage of the past. In other words, these treaties are looking forward to the future. But Obama's had to look at repairing past damage from past administrations that acted unilaterally, starting with the beginning of the Cold War almost up to the present. And we can talk about that a little bit if you wish.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, at the start of the Cold War, as the European empires that controlled about half of humanity were retreating, and 100 new sovereign states were emerging very quickly, starting in the Truman administration and particularly under the Eisenhower administration. There was a shift in global power. European empires were collapsing. The United States was ascendant as the world's dominant economy. We controlled about half of global production at that point. We were the overwhelmingly strong military power. And so the United States was emerging during the 1940s and 50s as the new global hegemon, the new power, many would say the most powerful empire that ever existed. And under President Truman created the new instruments of U.S. global power, the National Security Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. Air Force. And then under Dwight Eisenhower, he was the one that actually began to operate these new instruments of global power. And I think drawing upon his experience as Allied commander in Europe during World War II, Eisenhower kind of turned the National Security Council into his sort of staff. It became very large and met regularly, hundreds of times under Eisenhower, to review hotspots and make foreign policy decisions. So the National Security Council was his staff, and the CIA was his secret army. And Eisenhower, during his term, 8 years in office, ordered 170 covert operations in 48 nations. Now, among all these covert operations, there were three that were particularly disastrous and turned three sovereign states into bitter enemies of the United States. The first was under President Truman. In 1950-51 and into 52, Truman ordered the CIA to transform the remnants of the nationalist Chinese forces that had fled into northeastern Burma when Mao Zedong took power in Beijing in 1949, established the People's Republic of China, Communist China. Well, these nationalist Chinese remnants were then armed and trained by the CIA, and they conducted three abortive invasions of the People's Republic of China in 1951-52, and they were brushed back by mere provincial militia in the northeastern Burma. And then again with CIA logistics support and CIA arms and money, they basically occupied northeastern Burma. The U.S. ambassador to Burma resigned in protest. Burma took its complaint to the U.N., and eventually the Nationalist Chinese forces pulled out, where they ran the drug trade in northern Thailand for the next 40 years. This was a time when Burma was just established. They were only established in 1947. They were inclined to be insular. They were quite sensitive as a nation, and suddenly they found their borderlands being used as being sort of taken over by the world's hegemonic power. And this alienated Burma from the United States and indeed from the broader international community. So as President of the United States, sensing that America's encirclement of the Eurasian landmass that I described with the Navy and the treaties and most recently the network of drone bases, that China developed a special relationship with the Union of Burma and got preferential access to its very considerable resources and, more importantly, got a base in the Bay of Bengal for oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines that go right into the 100 and provision the 100 million people in southwestern China. But this was, if you will, a breach in America's containment. So he sent Secretary Hillary Clinton to be the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Burma in decades. He appointed the first U.S. ambassador to Burma in, I think, 22 years, and he made the first state visit ever by an American president to the Union of Burma to heal that relationship and to draw Burma away from China into the international community. The second one he did was, of course, Iran. In 1953, in the early 1950s, there was a popularly elected prime minister, Mossadegh, who challenged the Anglo-Iranian oil company, the British imperial control over Iran's oil industry, that's now BP, and he began nationalizing that company. The British intelligence and the CIA collaborated in overthrowing the Mossadegh government. The attempt nearly failed, but at the last minute it succeeded. They installed the Shah of Iran in power. And then over the next two decades, the CIA built the SAVAK, the ruthless secret police for the Shah, as a surveillance, torture, and interrogation unit. And while all of this, covert operations daring do was toasted in Washington as sort of deliciously brilliant, meanwhile, Iran was seething. And, of course, the events of 1979 followed the seizure and occupation of the U.S. Embassy, the overthrow of the Shah, and a persistent breach in U.S. relations with Iran that weakened Washington's position very seriously in the Middle East. Well, of course, we all know that Obama, beginning in 2013, began conducting those negotiations to check Iran's move to possibly developing a nuclear weapons capacity. And again, we don't know, but it's clear that this is going to bring at least Iran back into the international community and may, in the fullness of time, begin healing the breach between the United States and Iran. The last one, of course, was Cuba. Under President Eisenhower, as he was leaving office in 1960, he authorized a covert operation to send 1,000-plus ragtag Cuban-American exiles to land somewhere in Cuba. When President Kennedy was inaugurated and he inherited this operation that was all planned and ready to go, President Kennedy sensed that it wasn't quite right. He was young. He was inexperienced. This was in the first weeks of his administration. And so he basically ordered the CIA to cut back, you know, to land in a more remote area, to cut back the scale of its air power support for the landing. And what they wound up doing was dumping 1,000-plus Cuban exiles on a beach at the Bay of Pigs, and they were supposed to, you know, to go from that beachhead to the Escambré Mountains. Well, if you look at the map, you'll see that they were supposed to go through 50 miles of dense mangrove swamp and cross a bay without any inflatable rafts. In other words, they were dumped on a beach 50 impassable miles from the mountains that they couldn't get to, and the CIA in Washington sat back as the Cuban Air Force blasted the exiles into surrender. Well, as we all know, Pope Francis is the mediator. Washington is now recognized Cuba again. We've reopened our embassy, the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C. It just reopened in the last few days. And we're now looking towards the resumption of fuller diplomatic relations and the possible removal of sanctions against Cuba. And so these three breaches in U.S. foreign policy of these three embittered nations is something that Obama has also healed during his term in office.
Well, that's my guess is Professor Alfred McCoy. We are coming close to the end of the very enlightening interview with the discussion of our past history. I was not aware until I read your article of the, introducing nationalist Chinese troops into Burma. And that explains a lot, which I didn't understand until reading your article. The article, Grandmaster the Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China, which you can find online at Tom's Dispatch. What happens when Obama leaves office? Do you think this program will continue, or are the corporate players who have been supporting Obama going to come and talk to the next president, whoever that is, and explain what has been going on?
I think that the momentum for certainly the Trans-Pacific Partnership is almost unstoppable at this point. This is in this era of hyper-partisanship, where Democrats and Republicans can agree on almost nothing. All right, what's extraordinary is you have a Democratic administration, arguably the most vilified Democratic administration by the Republicans of any in recent memory. All right, winning the fast-track authority for the approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Republican votes. This is one of the very few genuinely bipartisan actions by the Obama administration. And this means that there are business interests behind the Republican Party. You know, there is that element of the business portion of the Republican Party, separate from the Tea Party and the more populist strains, that recognize the importance of this treaty in securing the position of the United States and U.S. corporations globally. And I think those interests are going to, you know, that are manifested in that bipartisan vote for the fast-track authority will mean that this is going to continue into the next administration. I mean, you know, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was the ally of Obama in developing this strategy. So if she winds up to be the Democratic nominee and the next president of the United States, well, it's very clear that will move forward. There will be an absolute continuity in U.S. foreign policy. And she's also, as a candidate, a former senator from New York, very close to the same kind of corporate and financial interests that are very sympathetic and very supportive of both of these treaties, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership. And I think if a Republican is elected, and it's difficult to say, if you just go for the two front runners, Trump and Bush, very likely the same continuity will come into play. This involves U.S. global power at the highest level, and it's at this level, just as we saw in the Cold War, in which there is still bipartisanship, bipartisan U.S. foreign policy comes into play when the most powerful U.S. interests are at stake.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Alfred McCoy, for this enlightening 40 minutes of history and bringing us up to the current situation and giving us a different way, our listeners, a different way of looking at the present situation and the visit of Xi Jinping to Washington this week. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Professor McCoy.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.